Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, welcome to the Kindling's Muse at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub. This is our flagship show, and it's always fun to come into Seattle, especially on a gorgeous Seattle day. Wow, it's finally getting the way we all come to love it in the Seattle area, and it's beautiful out there. Tonight we're going to be discussing the wildly popular book series by J.K. Rowling. Harry Potter is a series of 7 fantasy novels which have sold over 40 million copies. It's a multi-billion dollar enterprise, and it's a series that has really reached into the hearts and lives of a lot of people, and not just adolescents. As a matter of fact, I think you've all read all 7, haven't you? Mm-hmm. And passionately and enthusiastically, mm-hmm. That's going to be cool. Yeah. We've had a great panel tonight. Dr. Jeffrey Cuse, Seattle Pacific University tenured professor, engaging interpreter of theology and popular culture. Can we have a big round of applause for the tenured professor from Seattle Pacific University? Also with us is Reverend Jenny Spohr, producer of The Killing's Muse, film critic, ordained Presbyterian clergy, mom and mom-to-be. Let's have a big round of applause for Jenny Spohr. Jenny is due in October, and I asked her what the implications are for the fall show, and she says, well, I'll miss October. I'll be back, you know, soon. And I said, well, you're like the Chinese women in the rice paddies. Exactly. Just right back on the show. Boom. So that's exciting. Also with us is writer Suzanne Wolf. She is the executive editor of it's actually my favorite publication, Image Journal. If you don't subscribe to Image Journal, you should rush right out and do it. Preston is sitting right over here. He was with me on Orcas Island last week. And I handed him a copy of Image Journal and said, you've got to subscribe to this. And I just went off the board of that organization, but it's a wonderful organization. She's the executive editor of Image. She also teaches literature at Seattle Pacific University and is the author of Unveiling, which Publishers Weekly called a dark and lovely first novel. Let's have a big round of applause for Suzanne Wolf. So when we get into Harry Potter, I mean, it's such an immense subject. Let's start by just talking about why it is that you think this became so popular. I mean, what is it? Is it the plot? Is it the characters? Is it the combination of the above? Did it tap into something in the zeitgeist? Why did this thing take off the way that it did?
Well, it definitely tapped into the zeitgeist, and I can say more about that later, but also it was the resurgence of fantasy. I mean, we needed that. We'd had like 20, 30 years of contemporary realism in children's literature,
What do you mean by contemporary realism?
Well, you know, not the Berenstain Bears, but novels that were about kids with sort of problems, you know, contemporary problems, parents splitting up, drug addictions, gangs, and some of them are fine. Some of them are very fine, but it was a prevailing genre of, this is where you are, and we are going to write fiction about where you are, as opposed to fantasy, which takes a child elsewhere, you know, to a fantasy, you know, kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Really still doing important work, but very differently. It's not taking it kind of head on. It's taking it through somebody else's journey. Well, somebody else's experience in another place, another time.
And through the imagination, I mean, I suppose teaching about life, yes, but in a much better way. Because indirection is much better than direction, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah. And frankly, if you're a kid having problems, the last thing you want to do is read about another kid in a book having the same problems. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was a teenager, I was going through a very difficult time, and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings helped me through that time, because whatever was going on in my life at the moment, I could step out of it and go to a place where, you know, it was not like my life, but it talked about courage, perseverance, friendship, you know, truth, justice, all the things that I was desperately, you know, longing for, but in a way that I could relate to because it wasn't a mirror image of my own life.
Jeff, what do you think?
Well, no, I think absolutely. You know, one of the great literary critics of the Victorian period, writing about the Victorian period, M.H. Abrams, in his book The Mirror and the Lamp, talks about that in young adult fiction we have ones that are mirrors that show us exactly how things are, so we have to reconcile it. But then they also are ones that are windows that we look out from our lives to see another horizon maybe we haven't considered. And what fantasy, science fiction, they create these meta-myths or journey stories that allow us to suppose something other. And this is what George MacDonald did with his fantasy work, and this is what Narnia does. It creates a window to look out into a possible, and even in many ways improbable, that forces me in my imagination to have to rethink that maybe there's another way to do my own life. So there's a place for mirror novels that show us about the kind of the real grit of our world, but we also need windows too. And I think that what she did, what's brought up here is that we needed a window through to another voice. And it came at the right time.
Why did this thing hit kind of intergenerationally? Because they certainly are coming of age and they're connecting with younger people, but it wasn't just younger people. I mean, a lot of people of all ages really got into reading this series.
Well, it was fun being in Britain when the first novels were really exploding, you know, and the first ones came out, and I was living in Scotland, one of the things that happened is when the first books were really becoming popular, adults were embarrassed about reading these children's books, and so they actually started to make new covers with cool, edgy covers of the book so adults could read them on the train, read them on the subway to do that. And so the books that we actually have at home have these really edgy, gritty pictures on the front as opposed to the cartoonish ones that Scholastic has that are here. And I think that, again, what she tapped into, and we're going to talk about this as we go through, is there are certain meta myths that she is absolutely speaking into that is a story that I've heard before, but I haven't heard it in quite this way. But because I have heard it before, it resonates all the way through the other stories that I've hit. I think adults can relate to it because everybody's grown up.
Yeah.
I mean, it speaks into that very deep part of us is because where we are as children, we become self-aware. That big move is when we start school. And so when Harry starts school is when many of us start thinking about who we are. We move from the family unit, or the lack thereof for Harry Potter, to the institutionalization of how do I fit with all these other types of competing voices. And so the school narrative, that whole genre of the school year is something she tapped into really well.
So when you talk about meta myths, myths and the storyline, what are some of these meta myths that were tapped into through Harry Potter?
Well, I mean, part of it is the story of growing up and being confronted by monsters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, Voldemort, if I can say his name.
My scar is burning! My scar is burning!
Okay. But, I mean, as children grow in self-awareness and they become more and more aware of the outside world, they become aware that there are bad things out there. I remember my son, he's now 15, but when he was about 7, he suddenly became more aware that of the news, the things he'd hear or little flashes of things he'd see. And he became very timid about going outside. And I noticed this. He wasn't going out to play, you know, in front of the house. And I said, why? And he said, someone will kidnap me. Because he'd heard something on the news about a child that was kidnapped. And for him, this is monstrous. Mm-hmm. And of course it is. It's morally monstrous. Mm-hmm. So what fiction for children does, and especially fantasy, is that they sort of literalize the sort of, you know, the metaphor. Mm-hmm. And they make the monster. Yeah. And then you have this little character, which is also part of the myth, and it's in all fairy tales, where you have the little character, you know, Harry is like Tom, Dick, and Harry, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the normal kind of, you know, not the obviously heroic, and he is the one who can battle the monster.
The every man, the every kid.
So he's the every kid, he's the every child,
yeah.
And then that sort of, I mean, I hate to use this word, but that kind of empowers kids who are reading this. And they know very well in fantasy that this is not literal.
But they
know that it's, you know, the monster, not just, you know, the monster out there, you know, the kidnapper, the rapist, mm-hmm. the murderer. Mm-hmm. But, and this is where perhaps we can talk more about, and what I find a little lacking in J.K. Rowling is that she doesn't really account for the monster inside.
Hmm. Yeah. Hmm.
The way Tolkien does, the way Lewis does, the way Lloyd Alexander does, the way Natalie Babbitt and Tucker Blasting does. It's the monster inside that, in the end, is the scariest monster of all.
Yeah, one of my another theorist working with children's literature is Bruno Bettelheim, who wrote probably one of the most important works on kind of the importance of fairy tales in children. And he had this line where he says, the child is subject to desperate feelings of loneliness and isolation and experiences anxiety that they cannot name. Yeah. And we can all face that as children. We don't know how to put a name on it. We want to understand these problems we're having. And Bettelheim says, he goes, the fairy tale takes existential anxieties and dilemmas very seriously and addresses itself directly to them. The need to be loved, the fear that one is thought worthless, the love of life and the fear of death. Further, the fairy tale offers solutions in ways the child can grasp at their level of understanding. Yeah. And as a child listens to a fairy tale, they get ideas of how they may create order out of the chaos of their lives in order to have an inner life that can make sense.
Yeah.
And that's right.
And so you get a child picking up a Harry Potter novel, like any of these novels, and it's going to help them understand that as their parents are screaming and fighting, as they're going to school and they're terrified at this new thing called school and not fitting in, where am I going to fit
in? Yeah.
That there are these characters, these types. There's the Ron Weasleys, there's the Hermione
Grangers.
Well,
what are the types? Like, Harry is the kind of heroic.
Yeah, the average
and he's
child.
Essentially he's good. Yeah.
The reluctant hero, which
yes.
is, I think,
reluctant
also
hero.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what is Ron in this story?
Ron's awesome.
Ron's the kind of the foil. Ron's the kind of the true friend. It's like Sam.
He's Sam Frodo. That's right.
Yeah.
And how about Hermione?
Well, she's the smart kid.
She's the brain.
She's the one that figures it all out.
And she really is the Greek chorus. I mean, she kind of descends into these boys trying to figure things out, and she goes, "No, I just read this book."
Exactly.
You know, I mean,
it's exactly what you were talking about. Yeah.
And the other thing about Ron is Ron Weasley represents the pastoral purity of family before it's destroyed. Because the Weasley family, everybody wants to be a Weasley, right? Am I right about that? I mean,
I am a Weasley.
Yeah, see, there you go. See, but before we all got fractured, and before mom and dad had to go to work all the time, before they were separated, before they died, right?
Yeah.
There was this picture of a family with a mother and a father and siblings kind of all over the place. They didn't have money, but they had these wonderful sprawling fields they lived in, and it was pastoral purity.
And really, really weird sweaters.
Really awesome sweaters. But all
Christmas
of that, and that longing to be a Weasley on Harry's side is a part of it. And he doesn't realize he has been. Spoiler alert, he will be.
So now how does the Muggle play into all of this? You know, as a character, as a type, in this storyline?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, the Muggles are all of us, non-magical people.
Speak for yourself.
Speak for myself.
Yeah. She's a Weasley.
Yeah. And so they, you know, they play in interesting ways. I think there's, and Suzanne, I know you've talked about this a lot as well, but they play in interesting ways. So Hermione, for instance, is technically a Muggle. I mean, both her parents are Muggles, but
dentists.
She's got, they're both dentists. So they're both human. They're non-wizarding people, but there's something in some latent, I don't know, gene, she never talks about it, that she's got this wizarding capability. So Hermione gets to go to this school. So that's sort of this positive portrayal of a Muggle. You know, here's the smartest kid in the class. Here's the, you know, the best wizard of them all, basically, in Hermione. But then you've also got Harry's adoptive parents, her aunt and uncle, the Dursleys, who are just this horrible, you know. It's
the
antithesis of the Weasleys. Yeah. And that gets into that Cinderella factor for Harry.
Well, you know, I have a little bit of a problem with the depiction of the Muggles in J.K. Rowling. I mean, we have Arthur Weasley, who's the one character, it seems, who is genuinely sort of has a kind of love for the Muggles. The rest of the time, the Muggles are held up for ridicule and pity.
Mm-hmm.
They're not magical. And, you know, and as you were saying with Hermione, where did she get her magic from? Who decides?
Yeah.
You know, And so it seems to me a little bit, it worries me a little bit because it's quite elitist, the magic, you know, mm-hmm. being magical.
Right.
And the Muggles, as the actual word suggests, are sort of boring and mm-hmm. kind of, you know, poor things. You know, mm-hmm. a sort of slave race. Oh no, that's creature. He's a slave race, mm-hmm. From the slave race.
Yeah.
So this elitism, and it's a strain of elitism that runs through Harry Potter, disturbs me a little bit.
Well, is there something that you see as, now you're a Canadian citizen, but you were raised in Britain.
Educated
in Britain.
Yeah.
Is there something that you see going on in the class issue that maybe a lot of us Americans wouldn't see? And you wrote a piece in which you said, Harry is the natural child of progressive liberalism.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that you might be seeing that the typical American is, you know, how do you see that?
I think he is. I mean, they're the enlightened ones, right? The wizards mm-hmm. and the witches. And the Muggles are unenlightened. And I do see a class thing going on because I'm British. Very much so. And but of course, I think that class thing goes on here too.
Sure.
I mean, you know, when the sort of elites on the East Coast and the West Coast talk about flyover country, mm-hmm. they might as well just say the Muggles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's the attitude.
Sure. Sure.
And so I think that Hogwarts is a microcosm, being a school story, it's a microcosm of society, mm-hmm. the school. It's a microcosm of a progressive liberal society.
But isn't it significant that the two best friends of Harry are Muggles?
But that's, I think, just window dressing.
Really?
You don't think
that's essential to what she's doing there?
Not really. I think that she was aware that it might come across as kind of snobbery in a sort of elitism, because I think she realized she had a problem there, because Malfoy mm-hmm. and the Malfoys are the kind of upper crust kind of mm-hmm. snobs, you
yes.
know, the elitists. And I think that she may have sensed that she was setting that up at Hogwarts in ways that she didn't, you know, were problematic to her writing.
Hmm. And it's interesting too that Voldemort is a Muggle.
I mean, yes, he's half blood.
He has Muggle blood,
and so
there's a whole part of that too. Is like of you know what we call in race studies. I mean, passing, yeah. right? So he's trying to pass as pure when he's actually not. And mm-hmm. so we do get some of the race relation questions. You certainly get it in the whole elf narrative, the house
yes.
elf narrative that's
yes.
played out.
Yes.
So she certainly plays that idea out, and she does play with Muggles. I do think just to you know one of the things about the Muggles that I think is interesting is that there is no sense of kind of an innateism to who gets to be a wizard, who
yeah.
isn't.
Yeah.
There really is a sense of, I mean, calling. I mean, we don't know why, but Hermione was brought into this. And she doesn't have a biological right to it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something that, regardless of that, she is called into it. And that's the thing I think I actually do like about the direction that she has taken it, is that we don't get to choose.
Yeah.
you know, we are chosen for this thing. And that may be unsettling in many ways.
Yeah.
But I do agree that there is a place where the Muggles do take a kind of a straw man place in her story. And
sure.
there's not Muggles saving the day, really. I mean, it's really, if the Wizarding World falls apart, then the Muggle world will fall apart.
Well,
right?
there's a scene in... Oh, which one is it? It's in the Prisoner of Azkaban. No, it's in the Goblet of Fire at the very beginning where you see, and I think it's via a dream or something, but you see the old groundsman
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
who sees a light in the Voldemort house and
right.
he goes up. Now, in the movie, you don't see what happens to him, but in the book, he's killed.
Yeah, by Ngigi, the snake.
No.
Horribly
yeah.
killed.
Yeah. Yes, right.
And we do learn in the book that he's like a veteran of World War II, he's always been very faithful to the Voldemort family, etc. And there's no real regret in the book.
Mm-hmm.
There's no grief that this is an outrage. I mean, really.
Mm-hmm.
He's just another casualty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that is very revealing
mm-hmm.
to J.K. Rowling's kind of mindset, is that I think she really does privilege
the wizarding
world. The magicians.
World. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Over
well,
the muggles.
Don't you, though, from a literary standpoint, you kind of have to have those juxtapositions, though, for the wizarding world to work. I mean, isn't there a sense that it has to be other? It has to be slightly elite. And obviously, because it's magic, we're just going to assume it's better because I don't have to wash the dishes. I flick my wand and they're done, you know, that type of thing. I mean, isn't that sort of have to be set up in the books to really make them work? I mean, some sort of delineation. Or you
well,
don't? You,
well,
you think
no.
It's too...
I mean, I think that there are books, for example, Tuck Everlasting by Natalie Babbitt, where you have this family who have accidentally drunk from a stream of sort of bewitched or magical water, and it has made them immortal. So you'd mm-hmm. think that would give them, you know, I'm immortal, I can't die, we're gods, right? Mm-hmm. But actually what Natalie Babbitt does in that wonderful book is show that this is a deep suffering for them, because of course they lose all their friends, and they even lose the spouses that didn't drink. And so there's this sense of responsibility and the weight of their humanity that cannot die, which becomes intolerable. And there's a tragic sense of life there, whereas what I see in J.K. Rowling is not a tragic sense of life. I see triumphalism. And again, getting back to the monsters inside, and maybe we can talk about Harry a little bit and his character, is that Harry, he doesn't have to struggle very much against his own monsters. He's given a lot. Mm-hmm. He's given things. He's given, you know, he's given the Marauder's map. He's given the invisibility cloak. Mm-hmm. He's given this. He's given that. He's given the edge in the Triwizard contest. You know, he's told about Gillyweed.
Right.
That will you know, and he lucks out a lot. Mm-hmm. I'd like to have his luck. He even drinks luck. I want some of that. I mean, he is very, very privileged.
There is the reluctant hero piece, though, where he's getting this stuff at the last minute, just in time. Mm-hmm. It's like he doesn't know that he's going to get it. He does get it. But that's part of the kind of the mystique of Harry. That's what makes you wonder, is he going to survive this one? And it's interesting, but this series took 7 books. And that gives you a lot of time for the arc of the story and the character development. And if you took 2 characters, Harry and Voldemort, what is the arc of each of their stories? And what's the significance of that for the overall metaphor and mythology of this
story? Well, and they are the... I mean, there's so many layers on that in itself, because, I mean, Tom Riddle, you know, who's going to become Voldemort, you know, is Harry Potter in many ways, right? He's the dark side of what Harry Potter becomes.
Yes.
Both of them come from these interesting beginnings, right? And they take these roads that they could become each other, right? I mean, Harry could have been in Slytherin House, right? Mm-hmm. And it's always been the thing in his life. And as you go back to the backstory of what Voldemort becomes, he sees himself in it. Matter of fact, they are the same person in many ways. Yeah. And as we get into kind of talking about Horcruxes and things, I mean the infection of Voldemort's life as a part of him is what makes his life part. This is what, you know, Jung talks about as far as owning your shadow. Mm-hmm. I mean, in order for Harry to make sense of his life, he's going to have to own Voldemort is the shadow side of who he is. And so their narratives come and meet, you know, at the very last book. But as you kind of start tracing the Tom Riddle story all the way through, it doesn't take too much, you know, hard work to see that this is for the kids, it's like, do you want to go this way or that way? But also, and this is another part of it too, is that Harry also has to choose a father figure, you know, with the death of his parents, because I mean, you know, he does get everything he wants except the very thing he wants, right? Which is his parents back, right? And so it's again one of these great stories of, you know, the poor little rich child, which is another meta myth, right? Who has the entire world but doesn't have love, and so Harry, you know, from the very beginning, you know, in the Philosopher's Stone, you know, wants to just stare at because his parents are everything he wants, and same thing with Riddle. Riddle wanted that love, and Voldemort actually becomes one of those figures, but so does Dumbledore.
Yeah.
Right? And so he has to kind of figure out, you know, who is my mentor? And this is core to these coming-of-age novels, the Bildungsroman tradition of coming-of-age from the 18th century onward, mm-hmm. where these children have to choose a mentor other than their parents in order for them to become adults.
Mm-hmm. Except that there's no real sort of conflict within Harry about being attracted to Voldemort. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's structurally there, yeah. but it's not in his character.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not been written into his character. And that would have made it very strong, I think.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We're going to be back with more coming up right after this. You're listening to Kindling's Muse at Hales, Ales, Brewery, and Pub. Everything you wanted to know about Harry Potter and were afraid to ask. In a very, very brief show. We'll be back with more right after this. Don't go away. Next time, back with you. You're listening to the Kindling's Muse at Hales, Ales, Brewery, and Pub, and we're having a great conversation tonight that's way over my head about Harry Potter. It's been fascinating. I really am enjoying it. And our panelists tonight are Dr. Jeff Cuse, tenured professor at Seattle Pacific University. Also,
everybody drink. Every time we say tenured island.
Reverend Jenny Spohr and Suzanne Wolf. And let's have a big round of applause
yes.
for all of our guests tonight. And we were talking about the kind of the arc of the story. And when you look at Voldemort, what is the role that he's playing in this seven series, book series? And is it convincing? In other words, does he actually represent a fear factor?
Incarnate.
Do we believe that he is a threat to Harry Potter? Is it sustainable over seven books? Mm.
Well,
and how does that work and not work as a literary device?
I asked my children that same question, and they said they weren't scared of him at all. And I said, why? And they said, because Harry always wins. Mm-hmm. And that was quite eye-opening for me, because I found him quite scary.
Yeah.
But they never felt threatened. I mean, they read all the books, and then they saw all the movies.
Interesting.
So they got both, you know. And they just didn't, they said, well, Harry's always going to win, so.
So was he an underdeveloped character? Was he not?
See, I think he gets developed as the series goes on.
Yes.
So I think in the first books, he just seems like, yeah, okay, evil presence.
Yeah,
yeah okay.
Feeding
we know
on unicorns.
Good,
season,
bad,
yeah.
Pretty good to figure out how this goes. But as it moves forward and you figure out that Voldemort is us, he becomes more terrifying. You know, to me, in that you realize that, oh, this is a little boy growing up in a situation who has unbelievable potential, and this is the direction he goes, and the choices he makes. And so the willingness that he has to divide his soul into pieces, you know, and to murder to get to that point. And you realize as you watch it that he taps into parts of yourself that you realize. I mean, this is the part that I think for me, Voldemort actually gets more terrifying later in the books than he does in the beginning. In the beginning, he just is kind of this spectral straw man character, but he actually gets more interesting.
But I find that Voldemort doesn't tap into us. I mean, that he's always so out there. He's the sort of the demonized, you know, evil figure that is out there, distant from us. I mean, even the Tom Riddle thing. And again, I think that J.K. Rowling maybe sensed that you know, Voldemort, there was no stake, that we didn't have a stake in it, you know, to banish him because he called to something within us. I don't think that's developed at all.
But the part that I do think does get developed is the fact that the people's complicity to support him as their Dark Lord. Yep. That's the part I think also.
Yeah, yeah, and you do feel more threatened by not knowing who is on his side and who isn't, ultimately.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking at the break about Snape, who, I mean, you want to talk about a heroic character, and, you know, and the way in which the Snape character moves through is really kind of one of the great unsung heroes in many ways. And the part that tears me up is the moment in you know, at the end of Deathly Hallows, where Harry's putting his son on a train and, you know, reminding him he's been named after the two greatest wizards, and one of them is Snape. You know, it's yeah. you know, that arc that you think this despised character, the entire thing, actually becomes the grandest hero. And it's because he actually stands between Dumbledore and Voldemort. He becomes actually the most real character in that way. And I think that complicity and how we participate in that complicity is something that's interesting.
Well, the reason I asked the question is Suzanne, and you've talked about Voldemort as an oddly impotent character. And I remember interviewing Ron Hansen, who you know. And Ron Hansen was talking about the difference between good literary fiction and, he used the term, Christian fiction, is that Christian fiction tends to be too black and white. It's not. There's not a real fear. There's not a real threat. There's not a. It's so characterized, and lacking in kind of subtlety. And his point is that evil has to actually feel compelling to you. You have to be drawn to it.
That's right.
In order for to represent a real threat. And I think what you're saying is
yes.
you don't ever really get the sense that Harry ever would consider going over to the dark side. It's much more like Star Wars, and there's the light and the dark, and you're going to stay on one side and fight for it to the bitter end.
And there's never, I mean, for example, let's imagine that there was a scene in, say, maybe The Half-Blood Prince, where Harry is able to go back in time and meet Tom Riddle so that they're both schoolboys. And Tom Riddle talks to him and says, well, I'm like you. I you know, my parents were murdered. I mean, he doesn't say I murdered them, but
yeah, right.
My parents were murdered. I'm alone in the world. And, you know, I have these extraordinary gifts, but I was made to feel like a freak. And we're really brothers. Mm-hmm. And if there'd been a scene like that where
Voldemort's trying to draw him,
you know,
in,
where or, Voldemort's yeah. trying to
right.
sort of seduce him.
Well, there's
a
little bit of that though in the Chamber of Secrets with the diary that he has, and he's getting a little bit seduced in the diary. And when he's finally down and face to face with him, there is this, you know, Harry's like, Tom, you know, help me. We've got to save this kid. And it finally sort of reveal. So there is a little bit of.
And this
that there, but not as deep as you're going with it, certainly.
Yeah.
And similarly, you have this, again, this is where all the books are mashing up in my head, but the one where he gets the potions book that was Tom Riddle's potions.
Yeah, Half-Blood Prince.
Yeah, for Prince.
Yeah.
And he is.
But that's Snape's potion book.
Okay. So, but the way that he kind of moves in and out of kind of claiming parts of Voldemort for himself and realizing that when he does that, he actually has power.
Yeah.
And how alluring that actually is. And so I think Voldemort does play maybe more of that, maybe not as overtly. As kind of a set apart scene.
I'm just thinking about Frodo and the Ring, for example. I mean, how the Ring takes a terrible toll on Frodo. I mean, he fights it, but then he sort of gives into it because, in a sense, he can't but because he's so weak and the Ring's so strong, and he's forever maimed.
Yeah.
Now, the scar of Harry Potter is not the same kind of maiming.
No.
That's already been done, and it's like a badge of honor.
Yeah.
It's not something deep within his soul that he... Because here's the thing. You know, the magicians, the good magicians and the bad magicians have the same attitude towards their magic, right? Mm-hmm. The bad magicians use it for evil, to murder, to kill. The good magicians don't. But their attitude is the same. It's the manipulation of the natural world mm-hmm. with the rational mind. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they both come from the same premise. And that's a big flaw in the book.
Well, how would you have improved on it?
Well, I mean, I would have done... I would have gone, like, you know, the J.R.R. Tolkien way, and I would have said that both are a dangerous sort of... a dangerous opportunity to control and to have power.
Yeah.
And that power is very, very morally evil.
And
made it ambiguous.
But see, this is where, okay, I'm now going to throw myself into the pit of fire on this.
So, all right.
So this is where I think J.K. Rowling is a better writer than C.S. Lewis in the Narnia series. I know, gasp, awe. And in some ways better than Tolkien. Right? Because the thing about Lewis and Tolkien and their...
Whoa!
I'm going to support you, Keyes. I'm going to support you on this
For this
very... Did I mention he's a tenured professor? Yeah. A little respect, ladies and gentlemen.
No, for this reason, and again, I don't want to get too out there, but I think...
This is a man who can't lose his job.
it may not ever be the Killings Muse again, but anyway. But here's why, because I think that generation that you have with Tolkien and Lewis don't like the transcendent. I don't care what you say. Hmm. Anything that is part of me that is extravagant or marvelous is a problem. We want the school kids to remain school kids. We want to keep them dressed up in their little things. I mean, in Narnia, Susan puts on lipstick and, oh, you're out of here.
Yeah.
Right? You don't get to come back to Narnia ever again, right? Let's keep them in their little school pants and little shorts and don't ever do anything marvelous again. Maybe you'll go back and you'll challenge the school system that you came from, but you don't get to be amazing.
Jeff. Aslan. Yeah, you don't get to be...
When did you get out of the short pants? What is it that
I want them back? No, but what you get with J.K. Rowling though is a sense that in us and in people, Muggles as well, sometimes if they're called out to, there's an extraordinary transcendence in them. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, now this is where it's different. She is playing a different game than we're looking at traditional Wiccan traditions, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you look at Wiccan religions and kind of earth magic that you have, and there is a strong religious tradition that you have with Wiccans. And she's not playing that game. She's really looking at metamyth out of fairy tales.
Yes. Right.
But what J.K. Rowling is doing that C.S. Lewis will not allow the children to do is to truly own magic for themselves because it's been given to them.
Yeah.
I really believe that. And I think that's deeply problematic in those books. Mm. Because what they really want us to do is to have a morality tale, not to have a transcendent experience with the supernatural.
Yeah, but not Tolkien. I mean, Lewis, yes, I'll grant you that.
But
Lewis had a domestic kind of imagination.
But similarly with what you get with Tolkien. I mean, Tolkien is making a very strong racist statement with regard to people with dark skin or orcs. People who have white skin are the good people. I mean, the people who live out in these kind of industrial things are problematic for me in my little pastoral life that I want to keep in my cottage, right? I mean, I lived in Britain. I saw that played out in myriad of ways. And what you get with J.K. Rowling is the kids have to deal with London.
Yeah,
they have to go to London and deal with it. And London isn't necessarily bad in and of itself. There's evil in London as well as in the fields.
Yeah.
And so what Tolkien does is like, pastoral good, industrialism bad.
Yeah.
I love Tolkien as well. But what Rowling does is she wants her kids to grow up and to be able to go to the city or the fields, and they're going to use whatever they can to make that survive. I think that's a more authentic way to write.
But that's very pragmatic, too. I mean, what we're really talking about is the imagination. I mean, magic is a metaphor for the imagination. But what does it say? And I understand in a sense that, you know, this resurgence of fantasy and after the contemporary realism, the sort of dreary, a lot of it very dreary contemporary realism, it's almost like the romantics after, you know, the Enlightenment, the 18th century, the Age of Reason, and they're going, woohoo!
Yeah, let's go to Widmere and write our poetry.
Yeah, exactly. But, though, Rowling's sort of version of the imagination is a progressive liberal version. Mm-hmm. What it is not a moral force at all. What it does is it enables, or as Harry Potter says in The Order of the Phoenix, when he's teaching, because he's the expert, he's teaching the other kids how to do spells because they're not allowed to be taught that anymore by the Ministry of Magic. Mm-hmm. And he says, you need practice, but most of all, you just need to be yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's a liberal mantra because, it's useless for kids, especially adolescents, and I have them.
But
let me just finish my thought. You know, kids at that age, they don't know who they are. They don't know how to be themselves. That's what they're discovering. And they can only discover it by being in relationship with other. And I just find this sort of the imagination then is some kind of watered down sort of super ability to just be yourself, to, you know, which isn't actually the imagination at all, because the imagination releases us from ourselves and points us to the window, to the world, and to the numinous. And you talk about the transcendence. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is any transcendence in J.K. Rowling. Mm-hmm. I don't think there isn't any numinous. The dead never come back. You know, there's no sense in which, you know, there are sort of rewards or punishments for good or bad behavior. You either fail or you succeed, mm-hmm. but that's a very sort of secularized version of it.
Let's move into another subject. You two stop fighting just for a moment. I want to get in, before we get to the live audience's input, how would we summarize the theology of this series and how it fits and doesn't fit with a Christian theology? Georgetown University, Pepperdine, Yale all offer theology of Harry Potter courses where they're examining themes like sin, evil, resurrection, and so forth. And J.K. Rowling herself has said that this series is, she says, "I believe in God, not magic. I'm a Christian. This seems to offend the religious right far worse than if I said there was no God. Every time I've asked if I believe in God, I've said yes because I do, but no one has ever really gone more deeply into it." And then she said, "If I talk too freely about that, I think the intelligent reader, whether 10 or 60, will be able to guess what is coming in my books."
Yeah.
She said that after like the second book.
Yeah.
So she's saying in these interviews that she's got a kind of a Christian theology undergirding this series. True or not true? How do you see the theology of this book unfolding? How does it fit and not fit kind of a Christian view of reality?
Well, I think it is definitely the arc of the Christian, you know, the ultimate myth of the hero's journey, but the sacrifice that he's going to go willingly and wandless to his death, Harry. And he's doing it to save everyone. I mean, he's taking this on and saying this is what's got to happen. I'm not going to duel this guy. I have to walk willingly to my death. And ultimately, the sort of big theme of this book is that love wins. Love wins. And in the Christian narrative, love wins as well. Even though it might look painful or it might look like it's not going to, ultimately, love wins in a transcendent, powerful love. And that's when, you know, you talk about sort of her sense of the imagination and how that's... I kind of disagree, because I feel like this, the imprint of his scar is the imprint of love, maternal love on her child. And it's not magic. I mean, as Lewis and you have also mentioned, it's a deeper magic than Voldemort realizes, or he just discards it. Oh, yeah, your mom loved you. Well, that's not going to protect you anymore, kid, type of thing. He completely discards the power of this transcendent love that not only his mother has given to him, but he has now developed within his community. So that's where I see major Christian themes coming into the story.
How about you, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, similarly with the scar, I think it's what's, I think probably of in modern literature, probably one of the greatest symbols that we've had has been Harry's scar. I mean, there's dissertations written on it. You know, that's not good or bad. But I mean,
By tenured professor.
Yeah, not by me. But that space that is both a sign of love, but also a sign of incredible evil, right? And that the fact that they're not separated, right? So they're not. It's not black and white. The scar is both.
Yes.
It's a representative of mother's love, but also incredible evil that's been poured literally into him. And as we, spoiler alert, makes Harry into a Horcrux.
Yeah.
Right. He becomes a vessel by which he's going to have to, very canonically, you know, as Philippians, he's going to have to kill himself in order to save the world, so to speak. I mean, he's going to have to go cruciform in order for all this to happen. So I think the scar is really important. The love dialectic is really important all throughout the book. I mean, the fact that Nerissa Malfoy, you know, breaks, you know, at the end, you know, for the sake of her son, you know, she's willing to sacrifice that, you know. So there are kind of maternal, but those are necessarily germane just to the Christian story. But I think the thing you do see in the Christian story is there is redemption. Right, so there are those who have kind of gone to the dark side, and they're allowed to come back, so they're not locked in.
So again, a
beef that I have with Narnia is that, for the most part, most of the characters are either this or that for the rest of their life. But you can move between sides.
Yeah.
So you can be redeemed or you can fall. And I also think this is the other part that I think is really amazing, is that what you get in the sacrificial life of Dumbledore.
Yes.
Right, the willingness to absorb all of this into himself, and this, you know, kind of plummeting fall that you have of him in the end, is such a mark of kind of a Christ moment in the stories that, you know, that my daughters, when they read the book, they see that without even having to me point at it.
Yeah,
they had an easier time actually seeing kind of the cross in Dumbledore than they had with Aslan. Mm-hmm. I had to work harder on the Aslan narrative than I did with Dumbledore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that says something.
Well, and there's some, I mean, when you're reading book 7, finally, and you just, again, like she said, if you have any sort of Christian sensibility, you're going to see this coming. I mean, when Harry and Voldemort meet, and Harry's dead, you know, quote unquote, he meets Dumbledore at King's Cross Station. Can I get a 2x4 over my head on that, please? You know, there's things that she's being really obvious about. And, you know, Hogwarts Express leaves from King's Cross throughout the whole series, but you kind of don't notice it until it's the title chapter, you know, for the climax of the entire series.
Did you want to add something?
Well, I mean, I sort of agree in that respect. I think that the sacrificial love is called, I think, an older magic.
Yeah, that's right.
In one of the books, and of the mother.
Yeah, that's a nice touch.
And I do think that she's trying, but I think it's sort of a bit jumbled. I mean, I think her kind of theology, if you will, is very piecemeal. I think she's sort of... I would see the Christian aspect as one of the many, many ingredients that she throws into her pot.
Yeah.
And I don't see it as...
This series is very derivative.
It's extremely
every number of directions.
It is. And I think Christianity is one of them. I think it's a...
In that sense, does it pose a threat to... kind of creating a muddle-mindedness among its fans and readers.
Did you say muggle-mindedness?
No, muddle-mindedness. Among the readers who kind of are already in a kind of an eclectic
I think it does.
Build a bear theology, build a god theology.
Build a body, that's right. I think it does in one regard, but I think it also what it does is it flies in the face of a sense of that Christianity in and of itself is kind of this one thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Bible itself is pulled together from an unbelievable number of stories. I mean, Acts 15 tells us that the church had to deal with pagans and Jews, and it's not either. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's this thing that brings together this hodgepodge of things. I mean, Acts 17 includes pagan literature as well as sacred literature in it. So as much as we think it's just one flat, very easy story to tell, it comes from a lot of different streams. Mm-hmm. And so again, I think that she's actually owning up to the way that we actually put our identities together.
Yeah.
I think that for a 21st century audience, she actually is creating this bricolage of bringing together pieces of things. And she doesn't do it quite well in a lot of places. And there's a lot of inconsistencies as a writer. Mm-hmm. But she does draw that together. I think I'm just going to get this quote in while I have a chance. Ron and Hermione, in the midst of their not knowing that they're in love because they're just fighting all the time... there's this one great scene where Ron is asking the question about these Horcruxes and trying to think, what do you do to put together, how does this work? And Ron says, is there any way of putting yourself back together once you've split yourself apart? And Hermione, of course, quoting the book that she's reading, says, yes, but it would be excruciating painful. It would cause remorse. You've got to really feel what you've done. But there's a footnote in the book. Apparently the pain of it can destroy you in the process. And I can't see Voldemort attempting it somehow. Can you? And one of the things I think about in that regard is that's one of the things that's the fatal flaw for Voldemort, is he's not willing to bear the true cost of what it takes for him to do what he wants to do. And that's also very Christian. He's not willing to go through the very pain he wants to inflict. Mm-hmm. And that you get something like Harry and Snape and Voldemort actually Dumbledore going through that, yeah.
Real quickly. When the book series first came out, there were book burnings. There were kind of fundamentalist reactions to it. The whole fear of witchcraft, Satanism, the occult. She was asked about it herself when she said the witchcraft accusations are absurd. Harry Potter's world is entirely imaginary. Yeah. I met thousands of children, and not one time has a child come up to me and said, Ms. Rowling, I'm so glad I've read these books because now I want to be a witch. She said, the magical elements of my book come from my studies in British folklore. Mm-hmm. What happened in that whole debate? Because it's like early on it was book burnings, and then as it got closer to some of the revelation of the storyline, people got a little warmed up to it, it seems like. Kind of in the more conservatives.
Warmed up and sort of burned out, too. I mean, burned out. Ba-dum-ching. Seven books, how many years, though? I mean, that's, 10, 12, 15 years that it took to get the whole series out. So by then, like, they're moving on to something else they can burn or protest or whatever, you know?
Well, I think partly, too, I mean, perhaps... Maybe this is wishful thinking, but perhaps they became embarrassed that they'd sort of jumped the gun and chosen the wrong thing. You know, I mean, it was such not a fight, you know, this whole magic thing. And, of course, you know, unfortunately...
But it goes to a literalism instead of a literary
approach to literature.
Yes. Because they have the same problem with Narnia. They have the same problem with Tolkien. Fascinating. Well, now we get to the exciting part of the show. We get to the part of the show where our audience climbs in the discussion and tears us all apart, which is a very painful thing. But we're willing, unlike Voldemort, to do it. And we'll be back with more coming up right after this. You're listening to Kindling's Muse at Hales, Ales, Brewery, and Pub. How are you? I'm Dick Staub, and I'm back with you now. Earth to Dick. And we're having a good time tonight at Kindling's Muse at Hales, Ales, Brewery, and Pub with Carlo at the soundboard. Can I have a big round of applause for Carlo? Yes. The horseman from the U2 concert on Saturday night. And we're going to get now right out to our questions for our elite professional panel. And we're going to get started with Neil. And Neil, what's your question? We're going to get through a lot of questions now, so let's get moving.
One of the things...
Okay, that's all the time for Neil. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
One of the things that I and my family love about Rowling's books is the names that she uses for places and for characters and the way they link to different identity things. So I guess it's kind of a two-part question. One would be just what are some of your favorite names that are in the book? And then the second one, do you see any parallels that are there just in terms of what we see in Scripture with names of, for example, Abram becoming Abraham and such and the development of characters?
By the way, Neil, have you ever thought about broadcasting? You got a great voice. Yes. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Well,
that was a little more Elvis than I was.
Yes, Frank has left the building.
Well, I mean, okay. Certainly in the Victorian novel, you have particularly with Dickens, you have a use of the name to make sure that the reader knows, without any doubt, this person is.
Yeah, big sign.
Yeah, it's a big sign, right? And so Rowling actually certainly uses this quite well. I mean, I think Severus Snape is such a great name.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I haven't talked about that. I mean, I love the Rowling books. I love her humor. Mm-hmm. And the name of the town in which the Dursleys live, Little Whinging, is... Because I used to say to my children all the time when they were little, oh, stop whinging.
Yeah, that's right.
Because it means whining, kind of, know. And so Little Whinging is perfect. I love it. And my favorite character, Moaning Myrtle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who you said you encountered in the ladies' room before the show.
Yes, that's yes, nice. I did.
Pretty scary for all of us.
Yeah, she just popped right up there.
Jenny, how about you?
Oh, gosh. I like how she plays with the names as well and uses some of them from literature and myth and things of that sort. I do like Sirius Black because it's that change, of, ooh, he's bad, he's black, he's, the dark, scary person, and yet he turns out...
By the way, Suzanne just illustrated something that's really important, and that is that you can love something and be analytical about it. Because throughout the show, you may have thought, well, she doesn't like this series very much. But what she has done is really thought through the series, be analytical about it. So you've got to learn to read at a couple of levels. You can read for your enjoyment, but you also have to kind of process everything intellectually. And that's a skill, whether it's a movie or lyrics to a song or a book series, yeah, is knowing how to kind of accept it on its own merit for what it is and enjoy it, while at the same time kind of running it through your grid, but enjoying it first, which is what Lewis said. You have to receive the work before you kind of make any analysis of it.
The second part of your question about, you know, how these names are like kind of the Abrahamic name changes you have in the Hebrew, yeah, Bible, I think probably the classic example throughout the book is the Sorting Hat and the various houses, mm-hmm, that people live in, and how they have to own their house. You know, and do I, you know, am I a Hufflepuff? Am I a, mm-hmm, Slytherin? You know, and I think that in itself is one of the things that she does, is that, you know, you inherit this tradition, you know, and now how do I continue this tradition onward? What is Slytherin House supposed to be? What does it mean to be a Hufflepuff? What does it mean, mm-hmm, to be Gryffindor? And I think that naming is something that's really interesting, particularly as the characters try to go between them, and the role that the Sorting Hat plays all the way to the bitter end,
yes,
of the book,
yeah,
as far as how that plays.
And that by the way is very, very British, or it used to be. In my convent school, we had houses, and because it was a convent school, they were named after great women or saints of the order.
Which house were you in?
Ball. Teresa Ball.
Mm. My favorite. Which house did you want to be
my
in?
Favorite, yeah, color. I wanted to be in like Ward or something because I like blue. We were yellow, and yellow, yeah, is like not my color. And so, you
it's
know,
a big problem.
Yeah, and okay, we didn't have a sorting,
yeah,
hat either.
Yeah, because the hat did you poorly. Yeah.
Laura, what's your question or comment?
So back to the questions of Christian theology, I was wondering what you thought of Rowling's dealing with the theme of death. How does she portray it? And do you think that is at all informed by questions of Christian theology in particular?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think she said this is essentially a series about death. I think she said, mm-hmm, that somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Well, and it begins with death, doesn't it? I mean, you, mm-hmm, know, Harry is deposited on the Dursleys' doorstep because of death. And he is constantly living in relation to the death of his parents. I mean, that's his narrative. He's trying to reconcile it. One of the things that the book doesn't do that they took license with in the film of the Deathly Hallows Part 1, because, mm-hmm, we have to split them in half for whatever, you know, economic reasons, I guess, two big blockbusters. But in the Deathly Hallows Part 1, when they finally come back to the town that he's born in,
yeah,
there's a very interesting scene where they're standing outside a churchyard.
Yes.
And they're listening.
Christmas Eve.
It's Christmas Eve, and they're listening to hymns coming out of there, and they're standing in this Christian churchyard looking at the graves of the parents. And one of the things that I was really struck by in that scene was just how Christian that entire thing was. I mean, this was a Christian churchyard. Being buried in the churchyard means you had been baptized. Mm-hmm. You had been made a full member of the church, you know. And so here you have the Potters, you know, buried in this churchyard, mm-hmm, you know, in a sense kind of living out their baptismal vows to the very end. You know, and so, I mean, so the optics of that in the film certainly show that to be the case. But I certainly think that the reality of death is very Christian. And,
yeah,
and unlike, I mean, some people just don't ever come back from the dead. I mean, you have to live with that. I think that's...
Well, and she says that throughout. You know, Harry, your parents aren't coming back. This is a reflection of your parents. Sure, this picture moves like they're alive, but they're not. They're not coming back. Even the, you know, portraits of the headmasters, you know, when Dumbledore dies in Book 6, you're like, at least he's going to be a painting on the wall, you know, because you want him to come back. But she makes it very pointed throughout that, no, death is the end of this world that we know. And she leaves that to mystery until the seventh book.
And what she does, which is kind of, again, a kind of a continuation of Hebrews, you know, chapter 12, being in chapter 12, the cloud of witnesses idea,
yeah,
is that in the very end of, I mean, in the Deathly Hallows, where Harry has the resurrection stone, you know, in this, mm-hmm, ring, he can use that to bring back this cloud of witnesses to give him encouragement. I mean, his parents come back to, yeah, speak into his life.
And there's, know, that scene in the, yeah, Triwizard, at the end, yeah, of the Triwizard, where mm-hmm, the dead come back and Cedric,
yeah,
comes back.
But they're still in spirit form.
But they're in
they're
spirit
not, it's
form.
Not a,
yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, yep. I think that deals with death
so,
as well.
So what,
yeah,
is your read on death in this series?
Dr. Sweat.
In 100 words or, yeah, less. Dr. Sweat, not a tenured professor yet, but working on it. Just got her PhD. Big round of applause. Yeah. Congratulations. Hear, hear. So say something impressive.
I hate being embarrassed. I think that death is one of the ways in which she does provide a strong intersection with Christian theology, especially because exactly in that graveyard scene that you mentioned, she quotes scripture on those tombstones, and that's, mm-hmm, the only time that scripture explicitly intersects in the books. Mm-hmm. But I wonder how much her portrayals, particularly of resurrection, mm-hmm. Kind of feed into a very spiritual understanding of it, as opposed to, say, bodily resurrection in the Christian tradition.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, well done.
And can I just say one thing quickly, is that I like the books, but I would say that I don't think she has a Christian concept of in death. There is, I mean, yes, the reality of death from a natural point of view, one of the most shocking things is that people disappear. They just go, mm-hmm. and they never come back. And we know that because we're human. But there is no sense throughout the series that... you know, Harry is sort of appealing to some kind of supernatural power like grace, or mm-hmm. or he doesn't pray. He, you know, there's nothing above Dumbledore, you know, and you know, as an authority. And Dumbledore is very, very wise and very powerful, but he's human, mm-hmm. and he dies. And so that I don't see that there is that, you know, real sort of sense of the supernatural in Harry Potter. I think it's very much sort of natural. Mm. And, you know, I'm not dissing the natural, but it is what it is.
Let's go to Helen.
Yeah, what do you think of the role of the Dementors in this story? Mm. And are there corollaries in our society?
Things that suck our soul? Boy, where do we start on that list yeah. of things that suck our soul and leave us joyless?
Yeah.
Costco on the weekend.
Yes.
Let's,
yeah.
Start there, just off the top of my head.
You can keep going.
Go.
A little stand-up routine.
Come
on soulless. Boy, I do think that there are things on a higher level that kind of do that to us. If we're, again, entrenched in constant materialism, if the only movie we ever watch is, you know, the Hangover series and don't ever see any, you know, anything else. I mean, things like that, right? It's fun, whatever, but maybe see Schindler's List once or something. I think that there is that on that higher level as far as things that literally, you know, suck our soul in our lives. I think we have Insensate Evil that we witness here on Earth all the time.
I think as well with the Dementors and this whole picture of, you know, how do we survive the things that are trying to kill us, you know, suck our lives away. And one of the solutions that comes very apparent in the book is that Harry was never meant to survive alone. Mm-hmm. You know, he keeps thinking that the solution is to keep all the people away, yeah. all the people he loves yeah. away. If I can isolate myself and I can be the one who dies, right. and that's fine. But, you know, Ron and Hermione, the Weasleys, and this whole group of people refuse to let him be in isolation. Mm-hmm. And probably in many ways, it communicates more about what the church should be. and so, you know, case in point, in the Deathly Hallows, you know, I mean, you know, he's protected by a Patronus that is not his own Patronus. Yeah. You know, it's sent by Snape, you know, to lead him on. I mean, over and over again, people intervene, you know, what Christians call intercessory prayer. I mean, there's ways in which people bound together. I mean, they refuse to allow him to be alone. Yeah. And one of the greatest values that Americans have is to be left alone.
Yeah, the rugged.
I want my own space. I want to do it my own way. I want mm-hmm. my own house. I mean, we don't have front porches anymore. We have back patios. You know, I mean, we want to be in the backyard where nobody can see us, right? We don't want people to see us anymore, right? And here you have this constant sense of, no, Harry, you don't get to do this alone. And the classic examples is in the battle scene in the very end, you know, is this yeah. parade of stars of these hodgepodge of people, you know, the classic line, you know, from Mrs. Weasley, who just lets it fly, you know, and just absolutely says, you will never touch our children again. You know, and this kind of sense of intervention that you get in that. And I yeah. think that's, so what the Dementors represent is kind of the sense of isolation mm-hmm. and the overturning of that is community.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Frank.
Yes. Absolutely.
things intimidating. What, in your view, what was Rowling's goal or purpose in writing this series?
$14 billion. got a problem with that?
Yeah. I mean, yeah,
that's the gross revenues from this series. Not to her, but still. Other than that,
we didn't talk at the beginning about the whole story that really the hagiography of J.K. Rowling, which has arisen. You know, she, you know, this welfare mother, you know, single parent, you know, who has this idea in her head, and she's writing, and she gets this British grant. You know, and I took, you know, tourists, you know, friends of mine who were visiting me in Scotland. We took the train over to Edinburgh. We went to the cafe where she was writing every day. We took pictures of them sitting at the table where she was scribbling out. There was a boy, and his name was, you know. And I think part of her goal is legitimate. She was an artist. She wanted to write. She had a story. She wanted to tell it. Yep. And as the series went on, I think she also legitimately felt a burden. I mean, when Order of the Phoenix came out, we were still in Scotland, and Blackstone's Books, which is a chain of books in Edinburgh and in Glasgow, had a midnight reading, which many people have. At midnight, everybody comes in and they can buy a copy of the book. And the big store there in Edinburgh, these kids came in, they were let in to buy the book, and J.K. Rowling was there. Mm. And she sat down with the kids and she read them the first chapter together. Oh, and of course it was a big media event and it was a big splashy thing. The publisher loved it. But you could watch her doing it, and she actually really loved the fact that kids were reading books.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, she takes a thrill about the fact that she got a generation to read again.
Yeah.
You know, and she really did. Between her and Oprah, the printed word was saved.
Totally.
You know, I mean,
may I add, they were both women.
and they're both women, single women.
Yeah. But in the spirit of one-upmanship, you wrote in a limo. Tell us the story.
Oh, yeah. Well, I went to a big book fest in Chicago, big gigantic thing, and. Of course, I was a very tiny little person there, but I got in this limo, and the driver told me that J.K. Rowling had just been sitting there, and the seat was still warm. So
Ladies and gentlemen.
Let me just. There was a joke going around Britain. Who is the saddest man in the world? The first Mr. Rowling.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Jonathan, what's your question?
In the book, Muggles are portrayed as basically powerless. Mm-hmm. The only time we see a Muggle confronting a magical danger with any degree of control would be when Dudley confronts the Dementor with Harry.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Why does the author not address the question of all the things that an informed Muggle could do against wizards?
Why does the author Rowling? I think because Muggles are sort of inferior. I mean, I don't think she really cares that much.
Suzanne, does it also go back to about what you're saying, that this is fantasy?